This is Maria Rizaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I will interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. Welcome to Episode 7, which is the first to be produced under COVID conditions. So gird your loins for the shock and horror of hearing the less than perfect broadcast quality of sound that you were used to. And while you're in shock and horror mode, stay in that gear, because you'll be straining your ears to get every oral morsel of this episode. The writer is Olga Ivanova, a mail-order bride from the Ukraine. Olga's marital opportunities were thwarted by the Chernobyl disaster and by the Afghanistan war, which decimated the number of young men in her generation. A chance encounter led her to unwittingly become a mail-order bride. And now, more than 20 years since her mail-order fiancé started to record her story and those of women in Australia who were in similar positions. But it isn't a tale of woe. It is a tale of adventure and finding sisterhood in strange places. Critiquing her is a business writer and video journalist, Lisa Crefield, British migrant who also married an Aussie at about the same time Olga arrived to our fair shores. Lisa is a superb writer, the mistress of syntax, I call her, an English Rose type whose own excursions into creative writing leans more towards period romantic novels, which she does just for fun, really. What will she think of Olga's Eastern European pragmatic approach to romance? Prepare yourself for that British sense of putting things in perspective that startled my own Greek-Australian drama-laden sensibilities. In a strange twist of events, Lisa finds kinship with Olga. Well, personally, I have never had my own prejudgments dismantled so thoroughly, brick by brick, or is that block by block? Okay, I'll spare you any further tortured metaphors and messing about with cultural stereotypes. Here we go. Olga Ivanova, welcome to the non-studios of 2RPH. This interview is being held during the coronavirus period, so we're in remote studios. There'll be flicking of papers, there'll be birds outside, and there'll be a little bit of thumping from people upstairs.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you today.
This is a fascinating story that you've got. What's the book going to be called?
The working title is A Diary of a Mail-Order Bride.
Great. I think there's nothing more direct. Everyone that has attended a reading of yours has been absolutely captivated. Is it a memoir or is it?
Call it memoir-based fiction. I included stories from others.
Yes.
And I also included possibilities.
Okay.
I also tried to add some humour. There is a bit of exaggeration as well.
Well, there's certainly some of these stories are very funny.
But in my day, I corresponded with the guy by mail.
By mail,
We were writing actual letters by hand from my first language is Russian, and the part of Ukraine that I'm from speaks mainly Russian.
How did it work? There were no websites. You couldn't look people up. So were there agencies where you
could? This is in one of the chapters I write about chance. I was teaching at university, and when I went downstairs, there was a woman there. She asked me, are you an English teacher by any chance?
You were working for a university?
Yes.
As
an English teacher. And she asked, would you be able to help me to translate this form? And I looked at it, immigration to New Zealand. And I thought, wow. She was migrating to New Zealand on a skilled migration program. She said, you know what? I'll find you a man there. Because here you'll never get married. And then found a very thick letter in my letterbox, and it's from New Zealand. And it was with four photos and four bio slips about the men.
So did that surprise you when you started to sit down and write your story? How did all that come about?
So the idea about this book came when I met women who had married men in New Zealand and especially in Australia, and then suffered in their marriages.
And you wanted to write the story for yourself or for them
for
as
them.
Well?
For them. Exactly.
So you
to empower and to say that, look, look at this, wow. You can do it, you can yeah. cope with it, just smile.
Yes.
It's down there. We formed Single Mothers Club, club of women like me who yeah. were married to Aussies.
Yeah.
And okay. every so often we meet and I read them a chapter or two. I yeah. add some more funny twists than I would publish here. And we laugh together and they say, oh, you know what? This is what happened to me. Write it yeah. here. Some don't even hide it that they went into the effort on the internet. And I mention it also how they met their husbands, yeah, like yeah. Internet order bride.
Yeah, internet order.
And so I included their experiences as well.
Yeah. Would you have imagined when you first were reading those profiles of the gentlemen that were being sent to you that you would be where you are now?
Absolutely no way. Still, even now, it seems like a wild dream, and that just one meeting with a complete stranger could bring me to this wild romance and all this.
So yes. what were your imaginings, or were you just completely open?
That time for me it was an experiment.
How much did you know about New Zealand and Australia?
I knew quite a bit because I studied English language. It was called country study. But I knew nothing about the culture of the people. I knew how much British tradition they kept.
But when you were corresponding with
yes,
person,
we were writing letters by hand.
By hand.
Not emailing or anything.
But were you able to determine something about the personality of your fiancé through those letters? Do you think that was a surprise at all?
That was a very big surprise too, because when you receive a letter, a handwritten letter, I formed my opinion based on the neat handwriting. I thought, wow, what a balanced person. What a, you know, you look at the handwriting and you somehow jump to conclusions based on, you know, the length of a sentence, on the description in the paragraph. Well, what's a wool buyer? Oh, he must be buying fabrics or yarn in big quantities and yeah. then selling them to a factory. Oh, I couldn't even think of buying wool from sheep farms.
So was there a big disparity between the person you imagined through these letters and the actual person who greeted you?
The personality difference was huge, because I formed my opinion about his personality from the letters. I was reading or adding information between the lines.
Yeah.
I was imagining things, sentences, and how he was writing. I think that he was asking somebody to proofread his letters. I don't know. But to me, it seemed like he was a super educated man, like he had diverse interests that go to movies, to theater, to whatever. In reality, he would come home from work, get a beer, turn the TV on, watch.
Yes. Okay, so here in this piece that you're going to read, you are meeting him for the first time?
Yes.
Is that where you're going to start?
Yes, it's our meeting in the airport. He's picking me up.
How long was the flight?
The flight was 38, I think, hours.
Let's dive in.
Okay. This is it, the moment of truth. I can see him and he looks just like on the photo. My suitcases seem to be slowing me down, but he moves forward with, finally, welcome to New Zealand, and gives me a huge friendly hug. His sea breeze aftershave scent is reassuring, gentle yet steady, something that can be trusted and relied upon. He takes the bigger one of my suitcases and we walk outside. It's quite chilly and I reach for my jacket. Come on, it's not that cold. And the car is just over here. Suitcases are in the car, and it's time to hit the road, he says. I look around and take a deep breath of cool, humid air. Kind of salty, quite foreign smell. Better hurry and get in the car. No, I'm driving, Shane says with a smile. Just as I see the steering wheel, where I'm used to having the passenger seat. I was impatient to get in the car, but came to the wrong door. Left side driving, I must remember. He checks the car as he walks around to open the door for me. He even pulls the seatbelt out for me once I'm seated and closes the door. He's careful and caring, but I feel somewhat apprehensive about the drive, not sure why.
The conversation in the car is stilted. Our letters were a lot more naturally flowing. We stumble with false starts, speak at the same moment, have awkward silences. I have no idea why. It's not our first date, technically at least. We know a lot about each other. I wonder what he is thinking. What are his first impressions? Do I meet his expectations? You know, I thought... So, how did you... We say at the same time, and then insist that the other one of us continues. Then, after an awkward pause, we speak at the same time again. I don't think I've ever been on dates as awkward as this ride to my potential husband-to-be, but maybe it's a good sign. Maybe what starts awkward develops into a dynamic and satisfying relationship. I look at him and notice that his skin is even lighter than on the photo. Is it because he's so fair that his fine wrinkles are more visible? My freckles stand out more as well compared to the photos, I'm sure. I would like to know if he's okay with it. We managed to exchange a few careful questions and answers, but not without, and so. From time to time he pats me on the right thigh, which makes me rather nervous. Not that it's quite hard, but because of driving. I always have both hands on the steering wheel, and would prefer that he does too. He also strokes my upper arm from time to time with the back of his hand and caresses my right cheek by pulling and tugging it with his knuckles. You normally pet a large dog like this in my part of the world, but I guess he is not fully aware that he is hurting me because he must be focusing on driving. I take his hand between my hands, interlock our fingers, and gently stroke the back of his hand and lower forearm, looking at the white, almost translucent, like rice paper skin, and hairs standing up. No, no, don't do that, he pulls his hand out quickly and shifts in his seat. I can't focus on the road when you do that. Okay, I see, I smile. I find it funny that he blushed like a schoolboy. I think it made it a bit easier for us to talk for the remainder of the trip. We suddenly started chatting like we're a couple, discussing our choices for dinner, making a list for supermarket. He patiently takes me on a tour of the supermarket, explaining that Pack and Save is the cheapest chain, but you can buy almost everything you need here. As we move from aisle to aisle, he shows me the package sizes and tells me to check not only the price, but the cost of 100 grams. A bigger pack is always better value, he says, as he replaces the tomato paste, juice, and sour cream that I had put in the trolley. So this is the first day in New Zealand. And now I'd like to read a piece when I'm invited to the family dinner. It was just the following day. And this is the big, big introduction for me. I'm terribly nervous. I anxiously think about meeting my prospective in-laws. And I must make a good impression on everyone. I plan what to wear and get my makeup ready. Shane arrives from work and makes a comment on my dress. I'm not sure if it's a compliment or criticism. I'm not changing it. I believe it to be for meeting my soon-to-be in-laws. While he's in the shower, I'm checking my makeup. As we drive to Shane's parents, I can see that their suburb is older. They have a brick and iron fence, and there are many roses in the front yard. We come inside, and my head starts spinning from trying to count the number of heads. I thought it was a family dinner. I give chocolates to Elizabeth, who I know already from photos, and she promptly shoves them in the cupboard. I'm in awe from what I see in the room. It's like on some of the private museums dating back to early 19th century that I visited in St. Petersburg. Not as grand-looking and with lower ceilings, but still, let's just say a smaller and somewhat run-down version of a St. Petersburg museum. We're shown our seats right in the middle, and I want to shrink to ant size and crawl under the table. The scent of lavender coming from the old furniture is grounding and calming, and it helps me to relax somewhat. The first thing that struck me was heavy antique-looking sateen curtains with valance and tassels on the grid glass windows. It is already dark, and I cannot see what's outside, In the pauses for chewing between exchanging a few words, I look around, trying to hide my wandering eyes. This house is surely different from anything I saw back at home. A royal-looking wallpaper, a large chandelier with intricate details, the ornate circle on the ceiling where the chandelier is attached. It looks so heavy, I'm worried that it might fall. I'm sure if John stands up right under it, he will easily reach the bottom, maybe even the middle rows of lights. I guess it helps when the light bulb needs changing. You're a bit overdressed for a family dinner, Olga. Do you always make such a big fuss? Elizabeth points to her denim skirt and sweater, and as she walks from behind the stove, she shows me the fluffy slippers she is wearing. Okay, I heard that our women put a bit too much effort into their looks sometimes, but I'm not changing my dress and half boots now. I'm trying to analyze the royal look of the room, lavender and air freshener. Or maybe it's lavender bushes growing outside the window. I'm drawn to the rug. I saw similar patterns in the movies about British royalty. It is well worn, must have been passed from generation to generation. I want to ask Elizabeth about it. When is suitable time? Probably between dishes, or if I get to help her in the kitchen. I'm hopeless at small talk and get easily upset by their jokes. Do you eat any vegetables other than potatoes in Russia? Elizabeth asks as she takes a bag of frozen peas out of the freezer. No, we eat potatoes with potatoes. Never seen an onion or a carrot in my life, ever. I didn't say of course, but I wanted to say it. Do you drink vodka? What sort of question is that? Checking if I qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous? Yes, I want to say. I drink vodka every time I win a hand-to-paw combat with a bear. But again, I just say no. I don't understand what's going on, and I find those jokes quite offensive. Did your parents think you would fall off the earth when you told them that you were going to New Zealand? Shane's father asks. It took me a while to process the question. I wonder if New Zealand exists on flat earthers' maps, and laugh to myself. I see a please explain look on John's face and ask if his family are flat earthers. If so, where New Zealand is on the flat earth's map. They laugh and appreciate my awareness of the flat earth society. Ah, them dickheads think that we're on the upside down side, held by superglue. Apparently falling off the earth is still a common harmless joke that Europeans and Brits especially get told on arrival down under. But I did not know that all those years ago. Elizabeth encourages me to help myself as much as I want to eat, but my gaze keeps wandering around the dining room, and I have the strange feeling that something doesn't belong here. The smell of food. I treat this room as a part of a museum. It takes a while to sink in that this is not St. Petersburg, that I'm not on an excursion, that I'm watched, and that my dinner is getting cold. I pick up my heavy silver cutlery and say how wonderfully creamy the potatoes are. The room is dwarfed not only by the large chandelier, but also by the amount of furniture in it. There is a display cabinet in dark mahogany color, showcasing fine china and various sports awards. With four boys in the family, there would have been a lot of competition, not only for attention, but for space in the display cabinet too. A side table, oak I think, a large plum-colour velvet chair with a throw of synthetic fur over it has wrought yellow timber arms. The chair kind of speaks to me, showing its well-worn smooth seat with almost no velvet left. There are many photos, a few snow globe souvenirs, and tiny saucers with dried scented flowers on hand-crocheted doilies everywhere. Would you like some more pumpkin or kumara? Elizabeth asks. No, thank you, I'm full. I probably could have some more, but everybody has finished, and Shane says he's ready for dessert. Mum made his favorite. I wonder if it's appropriate to go to the bathroom. Everyone seems quite relaxed, but as soon as I get up, all eyes are on me again, and Shane, Elizabeth, and John all get up at once. On the way back, I look around the room again. There is an old black bookcase near the corner of his huge dinner table. While I wait, I see what's odd about this bookcase. The shelves are different thickness, and looks like they're made from different timbers, too. I don't know why I notice such small details. Maybe because I'm trying to divert my stress. I obviously failed to make a good impression, still feel humiliated and upset about the jokes and criticism for coming overdressed. But maybe I'm overreacting. Dessert is served, and the timing is great. I need something sweet to feel better. Vanilla sponge cake, light and fluffy with strawberries and cream. I'm going to have a second piece if offered.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Olga.
Thank you.
And that was Olga Ivanova. When Lisa Crefield and I sat down and listened to this, we just dove straight in. I don't think I even introduced her. Recording this by Zoom, so excuse the crackling. I mean, wasn't that amazing? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, there's so much in it. There's lovely writing and it's so engaging. I mean, although she's from Eastern Europe and I'm obviously from Northern Europe, or what was Northern Europe before Brexit, there was some shared experience there. When I first came to Australia in the late 90s, I also went on one of those nightmare flights. I know what she means about the disorientation. There is a kind of subversion in her story, and that typically one thinks of a male or a bride, one thinks of somebody coming from an, often a village or rural community in Southeast Asia, coming to a more urban lifestyle. This was the reverse. This is a highly educated from an urban background who's coming to a very much more simple, traditional rural family.
Yeah.
What she says about farming is particularly amusing. She was thinking in her context of it being a factory, as I expect a lot of us might, but actually it's a wool shed, very much more traditional than she was probably expecting. And they've all got preconceived notions about each other. She did what I would personally do, which is dress up to meet someone's family for the first time for lunch. The fact that they commented on what she wore, to me, that kind of transgressed hospitality. I felt quite awkward for her there. This holds a lot of resonance, I think, for modern day dating and a lot of people who are forming relationships online, and particularly with the COVID crisis, because you can't meet people easily, forming very intense relationships, very long relationships, without ever meeting someone. And it's not until you meet someone that the chemistry is there or it's not.
Yes.
You know, what I find interesting about her writing is she's very, very detailed. She has an excellent memory.
I could see that whole room just spill out in front of me.
And the smell of him, I think she mentioned the deodorant or aftershaves, and she obviously has very perceptive, she's very sensitive to her surroundings. And she has a good spirit. She has a good sense of humour, which I think obviously got her through, which must have been a very, very challenging time, I would think, for anybody, a challenging experience to fly all that way and meet someone. And she says she thinks this man was possibly helped with his letters. Well, perhaps he was. I wonder, a female relative perhaps worrying about this lonely male family member.
And here she is, she's going in cold to a new country, but a person that she thought she knew. And of course, you know that antipodean humour is kind of wry and it's kind of a bit cynical and self-deprecating. But to someone who's from Eastern Europe and who's used to talking straight, has become very upset by the humour.
And you wonder whether how much of it is humour and how much of it is just rather sort of rustic bluntness.
Yeah.
To me, it was quite sad as well. It's very humorous, but it's that same knowing that you're going to have to kind of lose a part of yourself to join another family. And I think that doesn't change whether you're a male or a bride or a regular bride or bridegroom.
But the whole preconception of what I had, for instance, of what a male or a bride is.
There were certainly brides that came out in previous decades. There used to be ways that people would actually marry by proxy in different countries. So it's a good thing Olga didn't do that, because obviously kept her options open a bit. Things people always think about mail order brides. I mean, there is that strong element of, you know, the first night and do they consummate and what is it like? Moment of intimacy with somebody you might have met hours before. Yeah. And in this case, Olga was a grown woman and she wasn't a sort of, you know, 18-year-old Regency virgin or anything like that, but you get in this. And perhaps we shouldn't be surprised at all, because there's all sorts of people using Tinder to hook up, meeting up, sleeping with one another before they even know one another's surnames and never seeing one another again.
Then you're right, you've drawn that line straight to, okay, this is what happens in Tinder dates, really. And they do it via describing themselves. Yes, you've been corresponding with somebody, she had imagined something, but then when she actually got to meet him, it took me a long time to drill down to her, even in that interview, what was the impression he had on you. It was almost like she'd cut herself off. I was saying to her, did your heart lurch? Were you immediately intrigued by him, but it was almost like she was avoiding the bigger impact.
I was quite disturbed, actually, when he started touching her in the car, because it seemed rather... Well, I mean, she said it was like it was like he was patting a dog, which I thought, to be honest,
it doesn't augur well.
Great. She was used to handling a sheep, perhaps. Not a I thought she didn't really say how she felt about it. And once again, a veil came down. I want a little bit more, perhaps, visually. So she mentions Shane's skin several times as being very, very pale.
Very white, yeah.
Did he have blonde hair? Did he have blonde eyelashes and eyebrows? Because she paints such a vivid picture of the room and the furnishings that I wanted to see the people in it just a little bit more.
And this is what's so beautiful about the book. Remember when she saw the bookcase and she noticed there were different colour wood thicknesses? Yes. But it was almost like she was anaesthetising herself. The impression that the people were having on her was just too hurtful. Not describing them makes them even more monstrous in a way.
Yes, it did. They became these looming figures. They seemed very large.
Since COVID, the people have started, you know, corresponding again as a way of getting to know each other, because you can't actually hook up. All the fantasizing that Olga does.
Well, I think with, you know, when you think of wartime letters, you might correspond for years. And there might be, you might be able to send your soldier in the trenches one sort of photo of his sweetheart. But
what's poignant to me is that despite that whole veneer of practicality, that in fact there's these little wistful moments where you feel like she was hoping that it was romantic, that they were going to spend a life where they'd be going to the movie in the theatre and go and listen to music. And it can only speak to a less than practical yearning for romance.
That's why I think I did get a feeling of sadness from it from both sides. There is a disappointment as soon as she meets him.
Tell me how you think this will go as a book.
I think it's definitely going to be a very interesting read. A lot of people will definitely want to know those kind of rather more intimate details.
Yeah, she has promised that intimate details will come.
Knowing how she felt about it, you know, the next day, and whether it was strange or whether it was good or whether it was disappointing, he's not the one. That those kind of things, that's what we really want. It's the emotional learnings from those encounters that is what makes a relationship different than a friendship. Certainly interesting to, you know, see those culture clashes. There's an awful lot in there of interest and learning and meaning to a very wide readership.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
And thank you so much, Maria.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program, produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH, also in the studio of Jeff Farolo in Des Moines. I look forward to your company next time.